Well, it's good to be back here. Thank you for your prayers. And I was on the East Coast, managed to get a flight home just before the big weather storm hit. However, A.J. Roberts, who spoke to you here, our virologist of Reasons to Believe, she's still there. So hopefully she'll be able to make it home without any problems. But there was a church, it's actually they were in two different cities, Greenwich and Stamford in Connecticut. And if you're not familiar with that geography, those are the two cities that are closest to New York City. In fact, almost everybody who lives in those cities works in Manhattan, and they just commute back and forth. And it's really not that bad. I actually did the commute myself. It's like 45 minutes. You're at Grand Central in the downtown part of Manhattan. But an interesting place in that it was a congregational church that had me come. And back east, most congregational churches are extremely liberal in their theology. This one was not. In fact, it's very much like this church here. And they had a new structure, but you would think it was 200 years old because the architecture is kind of like what you see at the Old North Church. So they kind of make it look old, when in fact it's really quite new. And what impressed me was the distances that people would drive. I mean, here I was speaking, and we had people from Alabama, we had people from Virginia, Pennsylvania, Missouri, New York, Massachusetts, that all drove to come to these events. And kind of the message I got there is that in New England, it's really rare to find a Bible-believing church, and people literally will drive 1 or 2 hours to get to one of those churches. I mean, we really have a blessing here in that there's outstanding churches literally within miles of anyone who lives in this general area. That's not the case back there in New England. This church has two campuses, and I really appreciate their outreach focus, because there was this very traditional church, and they're trying to reach out, much like this church does, to the more liberal congregationalists. So they maintain all the trappings of traditional congregationalism. And so the pastors of the church wear these white robes with a white rope around their scent and thing. I mean, it really looks like you're 300 years ago going to church. But they purposely maintain all its, including incense in the services and all that, as a way to make people feel comfortable who are used to that very liberal, traditional Christianity. And they were telling me just how many people who are visiting from another congregational church hear the gospel for the first time. On the other hand, they have made an arrangement with a downtown center for a completely different kind of service. They basically rented a boxing gym, and so they take over a boxing gym on Sunday. And so I went into this place, and yeah, there's people all sitting in the boxing ring, and you know, there's weights all around you and exercise equipment, so you can work out while you're going to church. So I didn't see too many blood stains, so. But yeah, you can actually put on the gloves if you want while you're listening to the message. So, but it was basically designed for people who, quote, want nothing to do with church. And so they purposely picked a setting that looks as much different from a church as possible. I mean, can you think of a boxing ring being a place where, and the music was really different, and it was really packed with a lot of young people, mainly targeting young professionals and college students. And I was told ahead of time that it was a well-educated audience. Seemed to me like half the people in the church had PhDs. I mean, so, you know, I met six physicists just in the first service. So, yeah, it's a highly educated community, which is typical of Connecticut. They were surprised that I came in with four different messages. They're used to people who visit just giving one message in all the different services. And I said, well, it's something we've discovered at Reasons to Believe, is that you really want to go in with multiple messages, because non-Christians will come maybe to the first or the second service and they want to hear more. And so I'm actually kind of building messages that will take people from step A to step B to step C and so forth. And they really liked it, and so this is something we're going to have to consider for future ministry in the church. The four messages I gave, I led with Genesis 1, because that's usually the biggest stumbling block that people had, because the whole theme was science, the Bible's ally, and just showing them step by step how God has given us two books, the book of Scripture and the book of nature, and science is intended to be the ally of the Christian faith. So I gave them four specific examples. Took them through Genesis 1. Then we got to Genesis 2, the second service, where we had a lot of married couples and really kind of gave the message of what God was all about in putting the man and the woman together, not as partners for life so much, but as military allies for mission. And then the third service, which was in the boxing ring, was on the exceptional animals. So in Genesis 1, God uses the word create three different times, first for the universe, and then for the soulish animals, and then for human beings. So really targeting the soulish animals and kind of laying out the theme that the rise of atheism is correlated very strongly with the rise of urbanization. And here it was in a highly urbanized area, lots of atheists in the community, lots of them came to the services, but just explaining that in many respects, people living in the 21st century are more ignorant of science than people lived 4,000 years ago, because they're cut off from contact with the very animals that God created as a tool to communicate the gospel. And just explaining to me, to people, how indeed God uses birds and mammals as object lessons to communicate who we are, who God is, and how we can come into a relationship with God. And then the fourth message, we did it in a totally secular setting. We picked a girls' prep school, and they had an enormous auditorium, so we actually had the event in the auditorium. And the three services were all geared to encouraging people. This is the event to bring your non-Christian friends. And that's another reason why you want to give multiple messages, because people got to see in three separate times, okay, I can really trust reasons to believe with my non-Christian friends. I mean, for example, I personally will not bring a non-Christian to a church event if I don't know who the presenter is and what the content's going to be. And you got to give people the confidence, hey, this is something that we can trust. It's going to be a venue where people can ask questions. And so when we did the community event, over half the audience were unbelievers. And it worked out really well. By the way, if you want to, you know, if you've got, say, a three-year-old that you want to give them a head start in education, this prep school will do that for a modest tuition of just $30,000. So that's for the non-residents. It's a little bit more if you want a board. And then when they enter the first grade, the tuition goes up to a little more than $40,000. But what people tell me, if you want to get your child into one of the Ivy League schools, that's what it's going to take. Wow. You have to, and if you don't get your three-year-old into one of these preschools, their chances of getting into Harvard or Yale are virtually nil. So people actually lay out that kind of money just to, and then of course when you get to Yale, the tuition goes up even more. So, and by the way, my event culminated with speaking events at Yale itself. But what was really interesting in talking to people, number one, they're highly educated, but this was probably the first church I've been in where I had all these men coming up to me who were followers of Jesus Christ, but their wives were staunch atheists. And it's basically, yes. Usually it's the other way around, where I get, you know, the wives saying, my husband's an atheist. And so I was kind of asking them, you know, what's different about this community that we see the men responding to the gospel in such a way, and the women being, well, apparently it's the liberal politics and theology and philosophy in that area that's caused many women to become very aggressive feminists and also very anti-Christian in their perspective, because what these men were telling me, my wife is not only an atheist, she's a very angry atheist. I can't talk to her about it. But what was interesting is how many of them actually showed up for the community event. And there I spoke on cosmic reasons to believe, and basically making the point that, you know, it's in astronomy where we got direct access to the past, where we can actually directly observe creation taking place. And this is where we get the most compelling scientific evidence for the God of the Bible. It was phenomenally successful, lots of Q&A, and you know, we literally had to kick people out of the room because they wanted to stay and ask questions. But the other thing I noticed from a lot of these women that came up and talked is they said, yes, I'm an atheist, but I'm spiritual. Which means that, you know, I kind of believe there's something out there, but it's not a personal God. And apparently that's very common there in New England, where people are proud of the fact that they're spiritual. They believe in some kind of higher, they don't even call it a higher power. It's some kind of higher entity. In fact, I talked to this one lady, and I said, what do you think this higher thing is? She said, oh, it's the laws of physics. So, well, where did that come from? So, and a lot of them had this idea that that was all that was necessary to have eternal life, was to, quote, believe that there is something beyond ourselves. Well, we've been studying in this passage in the book of Ecclesiastes. Guess what? God has written that on the heart of every human being. You shouldn't be proud that you know that. God's put that there. Everybody knows that. The other thing that struck me is how many people didn't believe that Satan is real or that demons are real. But what was, and you really could see God's hand here, because during the Q&A time, there were three people that stood up, and it was clear that they were really facing significant demonic oppression. And so it really helped persuade these other people when they heard the stories. You know, one was a case of someone who had a close encounter with a UFO. Another one was a case where demons were actually visiting the person at night and waking them up, and they're actually seeing things happen. And just talking to these people, there's been a long tradition in their family, literally for generations, of open doors to the occult, serious open doors. And it's like, hey, it's not surprising at all you're having these experiences. But it kind of lays out Satan's strategy to get people to think he doesn't exist, or that he does exist, he's so powerful that nothing can stop him. That's been his strategy, literally, for millennia, is to do that. But yeah, the vast majority of people talking to really don't believe there's anything in the, that is supernaturally evil. Although, when you think of what happened, what's been happening in New York, you begin to wonder. So, our books literally disappeared within minutes. I mean, so with the first service, the books were gone. And so people had to go to our website to get them. But also what was really encouraging to me were people who literally had driven for hours to come to the event, were highly motivated to tell me that it was a Reasons to Believe book that brought them to faith in Christ. And they appreciate the fact that every book we write is designed to be an evangelistic tool that someone can give to a non-Christian and see if that can bring them to faith in Christ. So, being just 45 minutes from Manhattan, I actually drove in and did a couple of tapings with for the Eric Metaxas show. He's gotten a syndicated radio program. He's on about 100 different stations. Turns out that he's a Reasons to Believe fan. He told me that he's been studying our book since 1990, and that coming into contact with the fingerprint of God just transformed his life. So, but he was expecting me to be there on the phone. And he told his producer we're going to actually show up in person in his studio. And so he was rather shocked to see that we were there, but was also excited and said, we got to do more than one show, because that was just scheduled for one show. We wound up doing two shows. He wanted to do three, but he couldn't move Bill Bennett. So we just did the two shows. So, yeah, I did one show, then Bill Bennett did one, then afterwards we did another. So, all of the shows are taped. So he has he does 1 hour segments, and usually his show usually runs about 2 hours. He's actually got a good thing going. It's a 40-minute recording. then they wrap 20 minutes of advertising around the 40 minutes. That makes a one-hour show. And one of our the one member of our board of directors is there and says, "You mean to say it's just 40 minutes of content and 20 minutes of ads?" And I said, "Well, it's actually a little bit of music. It's more like 35 minutes of content." But I said, "This is really very good, because when I've been on other drive time radio shows, you're lucky if you get 25 minutes of content in an hour. Yeah, because it'll be 35 minutes of ads. I mean, you've listened to radio, and you don't realize just how much the advertising dominates what you're hearing." However, what Eric does, and I found that this is actually as big as audience, is that he posts the recordings on his website, and there you get to listen to it ad-free. So that's good. And he literally posted it within an hour after we recorded it. And a lot of you have been wanting to know if you could listen to the recordings. If you go to my Facebook page, I give you a direct link right to the show. And I'm also giving you a link to what I think will be for the second show, because that hasn't aired yet. It's going to be airing on October 6th, which is a Tuesday. But I kind of figured out what their URL address is. So I'm giving you what I think is the URL. But if it is any different, I'll correct that on my Facebook page.
Is he on KKLA, Eric?
Not KKLA, he was on KKKRLA, but I heard they just dropped the show. But if you go on his website, it kind of lists all the times, because yeah, it airs at different times in different radio shows. But the easiest way is just go straight to the archive that he has, and you can listen to it anytime. And the second one will be up there. By the way, he's going to have me come back when I'm, we're actually going back to New England next month to do a skeptics forum at the University of Connecticut. And so while we're there, we'll also spend some time with Eric. And by the way, he jumps from subject to subject. So I think he's got attention deficit disorder. And by the way, that's not in any way meant to be negative. To be a good radio talk show host, you have to have attention deficit disorder, because you need the ability to go from topic to topic quickly. But what was fun is, by using that strategy, there was just an incredible number of aha moments. I mean, this is a man that's been following Reasons to Believe for 25 years. But it's like, as we were talking, it was like he was coming into, this is really an important, just making little points for him that he hadn't really appreciated before. And that just kept happening over and over again. But you get excited and you make some kind of summary statement of the science, and the summary wasn't quite right, but it's like I couldn't interrupt. So just excuse the fact that, there may be some generalizations there that don't fit. He loves to crack jokes, but the challenge with Eric is it's hard to tell the difference between when he's serious and when he's cracking a joke. I mean, but he is really quite a funny character. And then we moved from there to Yale University. And some people used to be part of this class. Rick and Snoozy Schneider have been, literally for the last 25 years, missionaries on the Yale University campus. And they target faculty. So they have a very exciting faculty ministry there at Yale. And they invited me to be part of what's called... what's the technical name they had for it? I got it written down here somewhere. Yeah, Faculty Roundtable. And the strategy of this Faculty Roundtable is they'll invite maybe 80 to 90 Yale professors to come to a dinner event, and they have them sitting around these tables, and they'll bring in a speaker who will speak for maybe 15, 20 minutes. Then they hand out questions to the different tables for discussion. And each table is strategically seated. So they have Christians who are equipped to share their faith at, an intellectual level. And they make sure that they're getting the right disciplines together. So if they have, say, an atheist physicist at the table, they'll have a Christian physicist at the table. And so, and usually the ratio is about 2 to 1, 2 non-Christians for every Christian. So there might be, say, 8 people around a table. 5 or 6 of them will be non-Christians, and they get to discuss Now, they give us enough discussion questions that we could have been there till 4:30 in the morning. So you just kind of have to structure each event. The whole thing is supposed to be about 2.5 hours, and then people afterwards stand around and talk. But very effective. And what was interesting for me is there were a lot of astronomers there, and only one of them was an unbeliever. All the rest of the astronomers are very committed evangelical Christians at Yale. And so it impressed me just how many believing science professors I met at Yale. And the Schneiders actually set me up to private appointments with different professors on the campus and also with the speaker. The speaker they brought in is a guy by the name of Marcelo Gleiser. May never have heard of him, but he is the equivalent. Well, they basically refer to him as Brazil's Carl Sagan. So he's not a Christian, but he really likes to integrate different disciplines. In fact, he's got a huge grant to bring scientists, science professors, and humanities professors together. And he spoke on quantum mechanics. He actually gave a very good brief talk on quantum mechanics, basically explaining why quantum mechanics must be exactly the way it is. I mean, it sounded like a fine-tuning argument the way it was going. And they sat him at my table. So we actually had a really good time discussing at breakfast with him. And he was also impressed that I'd written an article on one of his research papers that he had published a few years ago. And he actually published a paper where he said astronomers are abusing the anthropic principle. If you haven't heard of that, it's the idea that the universe has been fine-tuned design to make human life possible. So what's happened in the astronomical community is that the anthropic principle has morphed to the prebiotic principle. And he basically called the astronomical community on their philosophical bias. So the reason why you've made this shift and basically talk about the fine-tuning design you need to get the prebiotics for life is you're trying to give the impression that the universe has got lots of sites where, you know, the equivalent of human beings can exist. But all you're demonstrating is there's lots of sites in the universe where you might get a few amino acids existing. That's a whole lot different from getting a place where humans can actually live. And so it says you're playing philosophical games. So he was impressed that we knew even that the paper existed because it was published in a quite obscure theoretical physics journal. But yeah, we had found it. And he says, what do you guys do at Reasons to Believe anyway? And he says, well, you know, I told him about the fact that I was at Caltech in the radio astronomy research group, and it was lucky if I could spend one day a month reading the scientific literature, and I typically only read in my very narrow discipline. And I told him the story about, because, you know, he's an astronomer as well, that when I was at Caltech, at lunchtime, we'd all go and take over a burger establishment in Pasadena. And we'd all sit at these tables. But we had a separate table for the ultraviolet astronomers, one for the low-frequency radio astronomers, one for the high-frequency radio astronomers, one for the gamma-ray astronomers, the infrared astronomers. And if you sat at the wrong table, you couldn't follow the conversation. And so the problem was, when I was at Caltech, is that all of us only read in our very narrow subdiscipline. We didn't get the big picture. But what we do at Reasons to Believe is we take people out of academia and put them in a context where they can do interdisciplinary work and they get to read more broadly, and how all of our scientists literally spend an average of one day a week reading the scientific literature. And we read in many different journals, not just one specialized journal. And he says, well, there's a real need for that. So, and what impressed me is, you know, he's been referring to himself as an agnostic or an atheist, kind of like what Carl Sagan did. And A.J. Roberts, who gave a talk here in the class on viruses, she stayed and texted me to the point that after I'd left, she began to make available Reasons to Believe books to the graduate science students there, and Marcelo came over and took three of our books. So I think there might be an open door there. So it was also fun talking to the evangelical astronomers and how active they are in sharing their faith. So that was quite encouraging. And then as I was leaving, Susie made a comment. She says, do you remember when you had this home Bible study? And it was in a home, but we had about 50, 60 people attending. And said, you made us do role plays. I remember that to this day. So he says, are you doing that in Paradoxes? And I said, well, maybe we need to start that up again. And what we did back in those days is that I'd have people here in the class take the role of an evangelist where they're meeting a stranger for the first time, and I would play the role of the non-Christian. And we would do different roles. Sometimes I'd play the role of a hostile atheist. Other times I would play the role of some Mormon that's troubled with what I'm reading in my Mormon Bible. Other times I would play the role of a non-Christian who's really seeking after God and just wants somebody to put the pieces together for me. And so you get to pick what kind of non-Christian I play, and then we do it here in front of the class. And Ross Hoagland came to me a couple of weeks ago and says, you remember those days when we had people in the class share briefly their personal testimonies? Anyway, I'm thinking of reviving some of these things we used to do here in the class. So that's of interest to you. And by the way, one reason why we stopped, some of you got rather terrified. You know, Hugh's going to call upon me and I'm going to embarrass myself in front of the class. Well, that's part of it, is that you need to get over the embarrassment. And keep in mind, what always kept me going is realizing, you know, if God wanted it done perfectly, he would have sent an angel. And but what he has done is he told the angels, butt out. You can help the humans, but you're there. We need the humans to do this, because as clumsy as they are and as broken jars as they are, as it says in 2 Corinthians 4, I'm going to use their brokenness, their clumsiness, their obnoxiousness to actually get the gospel out. And by the way, it transforms the evangelist. This is why he uses us, because of the way sharing our faith can strengthen our relationship with Jesus Christ. I mean, read Paul's letter to Philemon, where he says, I'm encouraged that you're sharing your faith, and basically documents all the benefits of sharing your faith. So, if you're interested, we can. By the way, the thing I noticed when I was back there in Connecticut is how many people I met who were members of the Paradoxes class through paradoxes.org. So thank you, Rich, for maintaining that. I ran into people who said that they listen to what goes on here in the class. That's what we post there. On the website. So.
Do people there hear my name mentioned?
They sure do.
Right now.
In fact, a couple of them back there in Connecticut were asking, what happened to that Hollywood comedian you had here in the class? And I said, well, he's gone on to York University in Toronto to get an advanced degree. So, but he might be back. So, they actually ask about different members of the class. They want to know how Al Lopez is doing, so I kind of give them an update on that as well. Well, what I'd like to do before we jump into Ecclesiastes 3 is just report on, if you go to my Twitter page, I give you, yesterday I think I posted 30 links to science research papers that give a stronger case for the Christian faith. But one really jumped out that I think I just had to tell you about. And how many of you have heard about the asteroid that hit Mexico and wiped out the dinosaurs? Yeah, that's the Cretaceous mass extinction event. It's not the most dramatic mass extinction event, but it's one of the most dramatic mass extinction events. They estimate between two-thirds to three-quarters of all species of life were wiped out by that event. If you're not familiar with it, it's an asteroid about 6 miles in diameter that hit the Yucatan Peninsula 66 million years ago and actually caused a crater about 150 miles across, and then a debris ring that is 3,000 miles in radius around there. So matter of fact, you can see the spill from the collision all the way through Tennessee and all the way down through Brazil. So it's a major event, caused tsunami waves 1,000 feet high to run through the Atlantic Ocean. But Science Journal, just 2 days ago, published a paper where they said, we've now been able to resolve the debate about what wiped out the last generation of the dinosaurs. Because the debate has been the asteroid did it. Another debate has been that the Deccan volcanic eruptions did it. And if you're not familiar with that, Deccan is kind of where Bangladesh is, and it spills into India. And there's evidence that there was a massive volcanic eruption, actually many eruptions, that took place at roughly the same time as the collision event, or the asteroid collision event. There's been a debate literally running since 1980. So that's 35 years ago the debate got started. Did the asteroid wipe out the dinosaurs, or did the volcanic eruptions wipe out the dinosaurs? And by the way, we're talking major volcanic eruption. We're talking something that would literally pave the entire surface of the globe with several feet of lava. That's so much came out of those super volcanoes in India and Bangladesh. And part of the problem is that it looked like some of the data was indicating we got wiped out by volcanoes, because you see evidence for the ash that would have come from the volcanoes, and other evidence that would pertain to certain isotopes that would tell you it was the asteroid that did the damage. But what's new is about a year ago, they came up with a very accurate date for when the asteroid collided, mainly because they were able to take advantage of what are called the Milankovitch cycles. And if you haven't heard of that, that's simply the fact that as the Earth orbits about the Sun, the shape of its orbit changes cyclically. The shape changes with a cycle of about 100,000, and there's a second cycle of 400,000 years. And then the tilt of the orbit varies slightly with a period of 41,000 years. Where they're actually able to see the Milankovitch cycle in the geological record that pertains to the isotopes that would be consistent with the asteroid. For example, asteroids have a superabundance of iridium, so they look for a certain iridium isotope, but they're able actually to link that with the geological layers that showed the variations in Earth's orbit, and actually came up with a date that was accurate to five places the decimal. So they got a very accurate date now for when that asteroid hit. We know the location of where it hit, but what this paper points out is we now have a very accurate date for when the Deccan volcanic super volcanoes began to erupt. And it's the same date as the one for the asteroid. And so it's basically saying what we've been saying at Reasons to Believe for the last 20 years is that it's not one or the other, it's both. And when the asteroid hits the Earth, it actually ruptures the crust of the Earth and has the impact of causing super volcanoes to erupt. And so the collision basically ignited the volcanoes. But what's brand new in this paper, not only are the two dates coincident, indicating that they're not two separate events, they're related events. There's a big enough asteroid that was actually powerful enough to ignite these supervolcanic eruptions, but that these supervolcanic eruptions lasted for 500,000 years, 500,000 years, and basically explains why we don't see a recovery event for 500,000 years. The planet literally becomes uninhabitable for most of Earth's life for a period of 500 million years. And so the asteroid immediately wiped out. I mean, for example, if an asteroid that size were to hit today, any animal bigger than about 3 centimeters in length gets wiped out very quickly. I mean, forest fires burn, grass fires burn, you get what's called a winter. And the creatures that do survive wind up starving, because for about a 2-year period, the asteroid will throw dust up into the atmosphere that blocks out the light of the sun and basically terminates photosynthesis. And so people think what wiped out the dinosaurs, because not all the dinosaurs are living in North America. The dinosaurs living in Asia would have been far enough away, they wouldn't have been directly wiped out by the heat or the shock from the asteroid collision. But the dust that gets thrown into the atmosphere basically means they got nothing to eat, and they starved to death. But not the only ones that starved to death, lots of life winds up starving to death. And then you get the volcanoes erupting, and guess what they do? They also throw ash into the atmosphere. Yes?
Fifth decimal place, can you translate that in terms of years?
Well, I'm trying to... Okay, the book that was going to be coming out in a few months that I just finished, I give the exact date in there. It's not here in this paper. I try to remember, I think it's like 66.015 plus or minus 0.015 million years, something like that. But don't quote me on that. I got to check my notes to see exactly what it is. But yeah, it's super precise, mainly because we're able to calibrate it with the Milankovitch cycles. Yeah, it's give or take something on the order of 10,000 years. Yeah, I got to check my notes to see exactly what it is, but it's incredibly precise given how long ago that did take place. And the date that they have on the volcanoes is not that accurate, but it's accurate enough where they thought there was a discrepancy for the two dates has been removed. Both dates are at the same time. Both dates are at the same time to within 50,000 years. And maybe better than that. But that's close enough for people to say they've got to be related. One event caused the other event. But the newest material is actually saying that the eruptions continued for 500,000 years at a very intense level. And so, I've written about this already on my Facebook and Twitter page, making the point this ranks now as a profound challenge to the Darwinian paradigm, in the sense that this clearly establishes that this is not a minor extinction event. It really is a major extinction event. You're not going to get animals and birds surviving this kind of event. And the amazing thing is, once the planet becomes habitable again for these animals, you immediately see them. And so you don't see the dinosaurs coming back. What you see happening is this huge radiation event of new mammal and bird species. So mammals and birds basically explode upon the scene. But mammals and birds have the lowest probability of evolutionary change and evolutionary advance. And yet this is the big thing we see showing up in the fossil record once the planet becomes benign again. And there's really no way any naturalistic model can explain a mass radiation event or a mass speciation event that extensive and that rapid in response to a really crippling mass extinction event. So, anyway, you can check it out. The paper is actually online. I gave you a link. Yes?
Do you have any comment on the new Mars thing where they have the flowing water or anything that we should know?
Yeah, you'll find that on our reasons.org website. I also put it on my Facebook page with links. I can only give you a link to the research paper as opposed to the NASA announcement, but also to two articles that Fuzz and I wrote about a year to a year and a half ago where we predicted that this very thing would happen. So it's and it's another great example of the web articles are not going to be the same as the peer-reviewed science papers. And so basically what I do in the article, I basically tell you what NASA announced and then what really happened. So NASA basically kind of gave you the impression that they had now found stable pools of liquid water on Mars and that the water was fresh and that this would be a great place to look for the, if that exists there, Mars has got up life, give us more money, we're going to go to Mars and find life in these pools of water. Yes?
NASA's not abusing the anthropic principle, is it?
No, not at all. Okay. What they really found on Mars, excuse me, is they found evidence, spectroscopic evidence, for certain salts, certain magnesium salts. And these magnesium salts are hydrated minerals, which tells them that magnesium must have come into contact with liquid water in order to make that chemical. So that's the evidence. It's a satellite orbiting Mars, and it's got a spectroscope on it. And they actually found in one location the spectroscopic signature of these magnesium salts. So they didn't really find the water. They just found the magnesium salts. But the magnesium salts is strong evidence that those salts came into contact with liquid water. Then they showed you some streaks on Mars, small streaks that have the character of being the kinds of streaks you would see if brine was flowing on that part. But the streaks are really tiny, so it tells you that it was temporal. Now, this is something we literally predicted a year and a year and a half ago in our articles, and again, I give you links to those articles, making the point that, of course, Mars has got water on it because it's being bombarded by comets. And comets are 85 to 90% frozen water. And so those pole caps that you see on Mars are frozen carbon dioxide. That's the dominant component. But a second component is frozen water. Now, because Mars doesn't have a single gigantic moon like the Earth, its rotation axis tilts back and forth. That's true of all planets in our solar system except for the Earth. So that's another, you know, come Thanksgiving, you might want to thank God for the moon, because the moon keeps our rotation axis nice and stable, which is important for advanced life. Mars doesn't have that, so its pole goes back and forth. Now, what that means is that when the rotation axis tilts over, it's going to cause the polar cap to move, because only at the poles of Mars is frozen water permanent. There are times at the equator of Mars where the ground temperature reaches as high as 70 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, that's right at the ground. If you go up a foot, it goes way below zero. In fact, one of the challenges for being an astronaut on Mars, it may be 70 degrees on the soles of your feet, but it'll be minus 90 at your hat level. That's because of how thin the atmosphere is. The temperature goes down very rapidly. However, there are times on Mars where the temperature is warm enough that you're going to have the a place where liquid water could exist. However, because of how thin the atmosphere is, the freezing point of water on Mars is identical to the boiling point. And so if a chunk of ice, quote, melts on Mars, it quickly goes to the vapor state, unless it's very salty. Okay, if you got something that's really salty, I mean, that's that, you know, I'm from Canada, and what we do on our roads is we throw salt on the roads, because what that does is it lowers the melting point from 32 degrees Fahrenheit down to about 15 degrees Fahrenheit. So even though it's way below freezing, you can still melt the ice if you put enough salt on it. So the saltier the solution, the lower the melting point, which means that you can actually have water in a liquid state on Mars even when it's, say, 30 degrees below centigrade, if it's salty enough. And that's what they've actually found on Mars. They found places where the salt concentration is so intense, you can get liquid water, say, at minus 30 degrees or minus 20 degrees centigrade. And there's lots of places on Mars where the temperature is like that. And now, it's still going to be very brief. Because of how rare Mars' atmosphere is, even that briny solution isn't going to remain on Mars very long unless it goes underground. And that's what they think happened, is it had some briny solution that was underground, got pushed up to the surface, and then slid down, and that caused the streak to take place. Yes? Well, a good example, and we got hypersaline lakes in the Antarctic. We also got them in Yellowstone Park and other places. And we're talking salinity that probably exceeds what you see there. So it's very salty. Think of the Dead Sea, kind of that salty. So, and that kind of raised a question, because NASA's whole advertising is, you know, we found the perfect spot where life can survive. Well, life doesn't really do that well in a briny solution, especially a solution that's that briny. And by the way, we're talking about brine that hangs around. So I said a liquid drop of water, if it's pure water, evaporates in 1 or 2 seconds on Mars. With this briny stuff, it takes hours. But that's a little bit different than having a saline solution like the Dead Sea that can stick around for thousands of years. And notice they call the Dead Sea the Dead Sea. Nothing really grows there because of how salty it is. Now, there are environments, such as what you see in Yellowstone Park, where they got a highly salt solution, where you got bacteria that thrive. And so that actually came up with several questions on my Facebook page. Hey, we have bacteria that survive in salty conditions on Earth. Why not on Mars? Well, I referenced a paper that I wrote a couple of years ago, and it was titled, Extremophiles Are Irrelevant to the Origin of Life. And making the point, yes, it's one thing to have bacteria that can survive under extreme conditions, very acid conditions, very salty conditions. And by the way, with Mars, you've got both. Mars has 60 times the sulfur content of the Earth, which means it's going to be highly acidic. So it's going to be very salty and very acidic. And we do know of one bacterium that can survive under both acidic conditions and salty conditions. But if you examine that bacterium, you'd be amazed how much of its genome is designed to repair damage. Because this is a bacterium that's constantly being beat up by its environment. But it's got a very complex genome that's basically designed by our Creator to constantly repair the damage caused by the acid and the salt. And the whole point is, this is life that's far more complicated than we call mesophilic life, life that exists under benign conditions. And, you know, we have no answer for the origin of life under mesophilic conditions through naturalistic process. You're looking at many orders of magnitude greater complexity. And moreover, if you're kind of looking at the building blocks of life, the building blocks of life under these hypersaline, hyperacidic conditions literally last only minutes. And so the amino acids will literally break apart before they can possibly be assembled. And so that's why a group of researchers wrote a paper years ago in the journal Astrobiology titled Extremophiles Are Irrelevant to the Origin of Life. There's no way life can originate under those extreme conditions. So just based on how much sulfur there is on Mars and how much radiation it receives, it can't possibly be a site for any conceivable model for the origin of life. Yes.
Bringing the salinity values a little closer to home, how would those compare with, say, the Salton Sea or Mona Lake or a saturated
I can't answer that question because the only evidence they got is this spectroscope on this orbiter that says we found these magnesium salts there. And these streaks are indeed caused by highly saline water running down the hill and evaporating in less than a few hours. Then that would fit. But that would tell us we're looking at something very salty indeed in order for it to stay liquid for as long as a couple of hours. Because, if it's pure water, we're talking only 1 second. So to get something that would actually leave that big of a streak, we're looking at something that's extremely saline. I mean, I'm just guessing, but something at least as saline as, say, the Dead Sea, which is 1/3 salt. Yes.
Pluto, its primary moon, is larger than our moon is in relation to Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Why doesn't that moon hold Pluto's axis on the same pole?
Okay. The size of our moon relative to the planet must be fine-tuned. So, for example, if our moon were just slightly bigger, and by slightly bigger I mean 1 or 2% bigger, we wouldn't have a stable rotation axis tilt. So if it's too big, it's a problem. If it's too small, it's a problem. In fact, there was a paper published by a British planetary scientist that said, why is our moon so close in terms of its mass to giving us an unstable rotation axis? And he basically wrote the paper saying, we know that it looks like there's anthropic design to explain why the tilt is just right. But why is it at the hairy edge of going unstable? And the introduction of his paper, he says, there must be more fine-tuning here that's important for human life. And he concluded his paper by saying it was also necessary for human civilization to thrive that we have a 24-hour rotation period. And we know about the moon-forming event. The moon-forming event gave Earth a rotation period of something like 2 to 3 hours a day. And so because the moon is so massive, it actually slowed down our rotation period over the course of 4.5 billion years, where today is 24 hours. And if the moon were a little less massive than it is, we would have a rotation rate today that would be too rapid for human civilization. And so he said, by simply asking the question, if the mass of the moon is fine-tuned to give us a stable tilt, maybe there's more to it than what we know. And that explains why we're at the very edge of how big it is. So the problem with Pluto is its second moon is too big. Moreover, it's not a single moon. There are five moons that orbit Pluto. And so then Pluto's not that big itself. So you don't get the same stabilizing effect, because the mass of Charon compared to Pluto is way, the mass ratio is way bigger than the case of the Earth-Moon system. Earth-Moon system is 1/80th. Moon is 1/80th the mass of the Earth. I forget the ratio for Charon and Pluto, but I would guess it's something like 1/3 to 1/4.
Yeah.
And that's way too big. Okay.
How Chip. Critical is the tilt of Earth?
Well, if the tilt were greater, it would make the seasons more extreme, and so the summers would be hotter and the winters would be colder, and it would warm the planet over the average. So yeah, tilting it over a little bit more makes the planet warmer. Tilting a little bit less makes it cooler. But if you tilt it too much, we get seasons that are way too extreme for effective photosynthetic crop production.
So how close is that?
Okay. You can tilt it back and forth by about 2 degrees and it's not going to cause a problem. Matter of fact, it does tilt back and forth by about 2 degrees. One reason why it's warmer today than it was during the Ice Age is it's now tilted at 23.5 degrees. You know, during the Ice Age, it was like 22 degrees. And so that actually made the planet a little bit cooler. So yeah, it does tilt back and forth a little bit. And so what makes it tilt back and forth a little bit? It's got nothing to do with the moon. You can blame Jupiter and Saturn. They're the ones that are causing us to have a slight variation in our tilt. And by the way, Jupiter and Saturn, and to a lesser degree Uranus and Neptune, are also responsible for the fact that the shape of our orbit changes slightly over the course of hundreds of thousands of years. And by the way, the more elliptical it gets, the warmer the planet gets, the more circular it gets, the cooler it becomes. Yes. There's two of you. I'll take.
I didn't mind.
All right. There's three of you. Okay. One, two, and three. All right.
Head up before these guys. As a former JPL employee, this last week I got lots of questions about this Mars water, and I shared all the things that you shared. But one thing you didn't point out, obviously, was that the early period of Mars, it had a thicker atmosphere before it lost its atmosphere. Because it has so little gravity, not a magnetic field, it couldn't hold onto its atmosphere. This is one of the things the papers didn't talk about. So all of this evidence for water, the mere fact the planet's covered in rust, and these hydrated minerals, also could be attributed to the early days of Mars when it was a lot warmer and a lot wetter, but it lost its atmosphere, I mean, very, very quickly, you know, to go real thin because the planet was so small and didn't have this magnetic field. And JPL, of course, doesn't talk about that at all.
Well, the paper does mention it, but they were not able to give a date for these crystals. But what they did argue, is that we should be able to see these streaks on a cycle of about once every 60 to 120 million years, mainly because that's how often the rotation axis tilt will flip over. And so you're going to expect a renewal of polar caps happening roughly in a cycle of 60 million years. So in addition to seeing evidence for water that dates back 4 billion years, you'll also see some more recent evidence, but it's going to be tiny, and that's kind of what they found. This is just a very tiny streak.
Yeah, the streaks would be new, but the rust and the hydrated minerals
old. That could be old, correct. So yeah, there's still a lot of uncertainty there.
And there's also still a lot of confusion about what are wind channels versus water channels, because originally all these things were all these riverbeds. And they determined finally that the 200-mile-an-hour winds that happen every 6 months, you know, carved a lot of these channels that looked like water, but in reality were wind. You know, obviously, I guess these channels are small enough and deep enough that they don't think they're wind. It's the logic, right?
Yeah, although they weren't totally certain about that. I mean, what's really interesting is you look at the NASA public announcement, and then you look at the actual paper that was published in Science, and what you realize is that the scientists were much more nuanced in the peer-reviewed paper and much more conservative than what they were claiming.
They have to be honest about why JPL does that, because they want funding to send more probes there, so they have a motive for being biased in their papers, which is really troubling. It used to be more truth-oriented and now more PR.
Well, I think you can also blame Twitter and Facebook, because people are highly motivated to get lots of likes on their Facebook page and Twitter page, and putting out something sensational is going to get you a lot more likes, right? And how often do people put dislikes in? Although I hear they're going to change that.
I'm got these giant lakes. I mean, the people that came and told me, it's like, how come we didn't discover these lakes sooner if they're so big and they're there? They're the opposite. They think that NASA's stupid and dumb because they found this big lake, And why didn't they find it sooner,
Well, as I read the web articles.
I get you, because sensationalism makes stupidity,
They actually thought that read the web articles. It's like, we have found pools and lakes of pure liquid water.
Yeah.
And what they really found is some saline salts.
It lasts for a few, maybe an hour at max.
That's right. Okay, you were next. Go ahead. You're next after that. I'm going to get back to you.
The moon came up. The last week and a half, they have the Source in the tetrarch.
Yeah, the blood moon, right.
Yeah. And then I was listening to the news. So three things happened recently. And then I was listening to the news, and they were talking about the air raids from Russia and, Syria. And they were saying something about, I don't know, I just remember the words Russia and Iran in collusion. And I'm like, that's interesting. And then even hearing about this morning at the service how, lots and lots of people in Iran are getting saved, big quantities of people. And I was thinking, it reminded me of something, I think it was like 25 years ago, I still remember being in the sanctuary, and you had like a map of some of Ezekiel 38 and 39, some of what's going on in Gog and Magog. And I thought, I wonder, has reason to believe addressed anything that's going on right now?
Yeah, we have in spades. I mean, I was actually featured in the movie Four Blood Moons. I was in there for maybe about a minute, because I was the sole skeptic of their claims. So I'm the sole scientist. But what was really interesting is, with the theater release movie, they also released about a 25-minute commentary on the movie, which featured a panel. And I was on that panel, and I got to say a lot more than just 30 seconds worth. So, and by the way, I put a link to, because that's now public. They've publicly released the commentary, and it features John Hagee, an historian, and a rabbi, and myself talking about the movie. And I'm the sole skeptic in the thing there. But I did post it on my Facebook page, and you can actually watch the entire...
It's not on Netflix yet. It's just a basic program.
Well, you can also get it on YouTube. It's on YouTube, or you can go to my Facebook page. I forget. Yeah, Four Blood Moons was the movie, and I forget what they called the commentary, but the commentary was released the same time. It's actually packaged with the DVD. You can buy the DVD from John Hagee Ministries, but the commentary is free on YouTube, and if you go to my Facebook page, I give you the direct link so you can watch the whole thing. John Hagee wrote a whole book, and by the way, it was on the New York Times bestseller list for like 6 months. So it's sold in the millions. And he's not the only one. There was a Mormon who put out a book that sold in the millions. There was two other Bible prophecy teachers that brought up books on this. And it's the whole idea that this has got to be amazing, because the blood moon, by the way, a blood moon is just a lunar eclipse, okay? They call it the blood moon, but it really is just a lunar eclipse. And by the way, I hope you saw it, because it's one of the best lunar eclipses I've seen. I had the good fortune of being in Connecticut when it happened, so it was in a beautiful spot in the sky. I got to see the whole thing. So, yours was shaded. Well, again, I took a photo of it. You can see I posted it, so you can take a look at it. But what John Hagee and all these others have been talking about is that this is unusual, because it's four different blood moons that are all falling on Jewish sacred holidays. But as an astronomer, I would tell you that's no big deal at all, because guess what? These Jewish sacred holidays are tied to the moon. And so, Passover happens when you got a full moon. The Feast of Tabernacles happens when you got a full moon. And guess what? You only get lunar eclipses when you got a full moon. And so the fact that they coincide is really no big deal at all. They have to coincide because that's how the Jewish calendar works. So, but they've made a big deal in the fact, hey, we got four in a row. Well, guess what? You get two lunar eclipses a year. Of course you're going to get four over the course of 2 years. But where they've really been, I think, abusing scriptures, they're basically saying each of these four blood moons coincided with a major event in Israel. Well, guess what? Israel has a major event about every month. So, I mean, again, it's inevitable that something's going to happen. I mean, you made the point. You know, look what's happening in Iran today. Look what Russia is doing. Well, you can say that's a major event. But guess what? Israel is such a volatile place. You're going to find something. And this is where I thought John Hagee was clever, because the other Bible prophecy people were pointing out specific events. What John Hagee said was, something significant is going to happen. Well, guess what? Something significant is happening. But if you listen to the commentary, I make the point that, number one, yes, Joel talks about the moon turning red. But if you read Joel 2 carefully, he says that the sign of the return of the Lord will be the moon turning red like the blood of a corpse, plus the stars and plus the sun. This can't be it, because only the moon is turning red. We're talking about, and if you go to Revelation chapter 6 and chapter 8, it also talks about the sun, moon, and stars being dimmed by a third and turning red like the blood of a corpse. Which is why I'm persuaded this is a reference to a major dust event in Earth's atmosphere. And if you read Revelation 8, before you get the sun, moon, and stars turning red like the blood of a corpse, it says one third of the world's forests will burn up and one third of the world's grasslands will burn up. That's going to put enough dust in the atmosphere that it will turn all the heavenly bodies the same color. This can't be it, because only the moon turned red. The sun didn't turn red. The stars didn't turn red. Moreover, it's an abuse of Ezekiel that you mentioned, because Ezekiel basically says these events will not occur until certain events happen first in the reborn nation of Israel. And it's something I mentioned when I was with John Hagee and the rabbi and the historian, is that this can't be it, because there are events that have not yet happened that Ezekiel predicts must take place first. I'll give you a quick list. It says, it will not happen until all the Jews are living in the land of Israel. So the fact that we still have 3 million Jews in New York City and 500,000 Jews living here in Los Angeles means it's not yet the time. Second thing. Okay. I'm talking about the events that you see in Daniel and Revelation, which basically presages, and again, I'm assuming a pre-millennial perspective. Okay, because amillennialists and postmillennialists basically say all of this is irrelevant. But the people who are promoting this are premillennialists. I myself am premillennial, though I'm not pre-tribulation in my theology. If you remember, what was it, 25 years ago, I took you through a 7-year, 9-month class on the book of Revelation, which you can still get on MP3s, thanks to Susan Haller. The whole thing is available. And they edited out all the announcements, which really made John Leslie a little, Tom Leslie a little upset. All of his announcements got edited out. So, but yeah, it's still available. But we kind of took you through these events. And so the tribulation period, from a premillennial perspective, cannot begin to tick until all the Jews are living in the land of Israel, or at least most of the Jews are living in the land of Israel. Now, I think what is significant is, if you were to look at Israel 20 years ago, only 3.5 million Jews were living in the land of Israel. Today it's 7.5 million. Half the Jews in the world are living in the land of Israel today. But there's still a whole lot here in North America and Canada. Now, the other, and there's some in South America. The other thing Ezekiel predicts is that this will not happen until the reborn nation of Israel takes political control over the ancient territories of Ammon, Moab, and Edom, but does not occupy it. And It was Winston Churchill who boasted that he created the nation of Transjordan with a stroke of a pen. But a stroke of the pen perfectly encompassed the ancient territories of Ammon, Moab, and Edom. And so one suggestion I'm making, or hypothesis, is something will happen in the future. Maybe the king of Jordan will die, or he gets assassinated, or whatever. And Israel comes in, takes control of the land, but basically says to the Palestinians, that side of the Jordan is yours, this side is ours. Because if you've got 14, 15 million Jews in Israel, the land is too small. You actually see it in the book of Ezekiel, where Jews will return to the land of Israel and say to the leaders, this land is too small, we need more room. And this is where they gain control of Ammon, Moab, and Edom, but they do not possess, they do not occupy it. They control it, but they don't occupy it. Now, they can put the Palestinians on the other side, and they can take over the entire West Bank area. And the third thing that you see in the book of Ezekiel is that the nation of Israel will become the wealthiest nation on the planet. Now, I think that's to be interpreted on a per capita basis. And they're not there yet. They won't be until they handle their military problem, because so much of the gross domestic product goes to support their military, which keeps the standard of living lower than it otherwise would be. On the other hand, I think a sign that this is not too far off is that Israel today has the highest per capita number of physicists and computer programmers of any nation in the world. And they actually have on NASDAQ the second highest ranking, second only to the United States in terms of NASDAQ companies. Okay.
Hands down, sorry, we're running out of time.
We're running out of time?
No more questions.
Okay. What I wanted to do in this class is segue from what happened there in Connecticut, where I ran into all this skepticism about demons, because what we're talking about in Ezekiel chapter 1 and 3 is how different we are from the animals. We know things the animals don't know. And we know is very depressing. And it's designed to be very depressing. As I've shared with you before, step one with trying to reach out with the gospel to a non-Christian who's never been exposed to the Bible or church or the Christian faith, you first have to get that person depressed. Okay? You give them the bad news before you give them the good news. And Ecclesiastes is a wonderful example of how Solomon lays out all the bad news and then culminates in the great news in chapter 12. But I'm taking you through the bad news. And one of the pieces of bad news we've not yet covered is that there are evil forces that are more powerful than us that do not have our best interests at heart. And as I've traveled around the world, I've run into places where the demons are very active. And everybody believes in the supernatural. Here in the U.S., we have this perception the supernatural doesn't happen. God doesn't work out miracles through us. There are no demons. There is no Satan. Nothing miraculous ever happens. And I think that's partly because American Christians are not sharing their faith. If you share your faith, you will see the miraculous. And, you know, our pastors right now are taking us through the book of Acts. And the message you're getting from our pastors is this. The book of Acts is designed to be the normative for Christians throughout all ages. It's not the exception for the apostolic era. It's the norm. And as God worked out miracles for the apostles to be able to extend the Christian faith, he'll do the same for us. But one reason why so many American Christians don't believe in the supernatural, they're not active in sharing their faith. Again, I commend you the book of Philemon, where Paul commends Philemon for sharing his faith and then documents the benefits of sharing their faith. And one of those is you will see the supernatural, powerful hand of God at work to encourage you begin to bring people to faith in Jesus Christ. But you're also going to run into the demonic attack. And, when I was in the Soviet Union, they actually had, every university I was at in the Soviet Union back in the 1980s and early 1990s had a department of occult physics. And I was often giving lectures to halls of physicists where probably a quarter to a third of them were demon-possessed. And nobody doubted it. They all believed in demons because they saw it literally every day. And it's because the Soviet government was so motivated to fund occult physics, because they basically were commenting is, that's how we're going to beat the Americans. the Americans aren't doing this, we're doing this, and we're going to get one up on them. Well, they suffered the consequences. They suffered serious consequences. Anyway, I'm out of time. Please read Ecclesiastes 3. We're going to integrate it with Ecclesiastes 1 and get you through the rest of the bad news. And by the way, we're going to go to those chapters again, because in those two chapters is a lot of good news. Also in those two chapters is a whole lot of science apologetics. You're going to be amazed at what Solomon got right, thanks to the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, about this earth that we live on. With that, let me pray. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for this time we've had on many diverse topics today. Thank you for the way that you're at work in our world today, even here in America. And Father, I pray that each of us would go away this day and you'd make us sensitive to the encounters, the people you'll bring across our path that you prepared in advance to hear the good news, the salvation through Jesus Christ, the good reasons that you placed in our heart. And Father, I pray that you would give us a spirit of gentleness and respect and a clear conscience, that people listening to our good reasons would also see your love being manifested through our demeanor. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.